This is Mame Warren. It's the 21st of February, 1996, and this is tape 2 with Betty Munger in Lexington, Virginia.
The Vietnam War. And I was in favor of coeducation, and I laughed a lot, and we had a good time, and I wanted it, that kind of place. And it was. Now it's much more, because of the women, it's much more, they're shoppers. They need a new bookstore. They need a whole new building, as a matter of fact. But it got scratched.
Now, you brought up another subject.
Oh.
You were there during the protests against
yes.
the war.
Yes.
What are your memories of that?
Oh, the most vivid, and they were the most beautiful spring days, May. And coming to work at 8:30 in the morning and seeing 200 students milling around in front of Lee Chapel, shouting and carrying on. And this went on. They talked all the time. Everybody had this sensation, I think, of being alive in a way that hadn't happened before. I remember one kid coming in and saying, "Washington and Lee has joined the 20th century." There were plenty of people. They didn't come to the bookstore, I'm sure, but ROTC kids, fraternity types, or the big shot fraternity types, the big men on campus, although some of the big men on campus were the most wonderful people. In participating in this thing that kept it within limits. Although kids would come and tell me where UVA had hidden dynamite, this kind of thing. Whether it was true or not, or rumors, I don't know. But there was a group of the students themselves, the protesting students, who the anti-Vietnam War, who formed a guard and patrolled the buildings all night as a protection. I remember Jimmy Laban calling me and saying, "What are these people who, when I got up to practice at 5:30 this morning, there they were with blankets around them walking the buildings, and what are they doing?" They were protecting Lee Chapel, protecting the ROTC building was under threat, but there was all of the porcelain was in the ROTC building, so Washington and Lee was scared to death that something might go off.
And who was doing the guarding?
The protesters themselves set up a group. They also sent a group to Washington to be trained as marshals for the big march, the 500,000 people march.
And who were they afraid might do damage?
The extremists, as was happening. And threatening to blow up Lee Chapel.
Extremists within the community?
I don't think so. I don't know. UVA was much more, they came, now again, this is hearsay, that there was, UVA had sent over a couple of people to teach people in the dorms how to make Molotov cocktails. Mm. This kind of thing. It was in the air. And so these boys who had been part of part, and this was very, very clear to me, that the people who had been part of the anti-war movement for a long time were much more sane, more stable, but the kids who hopped on the bandwagon at the time of Cambodia, Kent State, were all revved up. There were kids who, there was no counseling services or anything. There was David Sprunt, who was the chaplain, who was, they didn't have any body, and I got a lot of it. They'd sit on the floor, and not just at the time, but always, there were always two or three kids that I was just being there for. But during that time, there were several, and I'm wondering, this is the 25th year, I think, 67, 68. I'm wondering whether some of those boys will come back this year. I know one's coming because he's coming with his three kids to stay here. they were so hyped up that they were spinning. You know, there was this sensation of, and I would say, come back and talk to me in an hour.
Oh, and trying to settle them down?
Yeah, trying to talk them down. And I got outdone with them at one point because they were so busy fighting the faculty decisions. At the faculty met practically every day, if not more than once a day. Practically every day, fighting them, and that they forgot about Vietnam. And it was at the time of the invasion of Cambodia, which Nixon said didn't exist. And I got some newsprint. It was regular old newspaper stuff. And got the students to write, "Remember Cambodia," and I put it up on the wall because it seemed to me that they were getting off the track. It was just something to add to it. I was asked by many kids to write a notice to their draft board. And I always had one question that I asked. What would you have done about Hitler? And then we'd talk for a while. And what they wanted was a statement that they were people, caring people, not that they were for or against the war or anything like that. It was just that they were to be honored in their opinions, and I gladly did that. That I would write a statement about them, and I have letters in. I have a folder of letters like this, the correspondence. I wrote a lot of letters during that time to the kids who graduated and who had gone to Vietnam. Mm. I kept letters going to them. And many of the kids I have kept in touch with over the years. A lot of them turn up and say, "Is Mrs. Munger still alive?"
All right, I'll get back now to let you free. That last question that I had.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that you are in a tradition of a number of very important women at Washington and Lee. And yet it's supposed to be this male bastion.
Well, look who they got to give money. Letitia Page Evans, Jesse Ball DuPont, Miss Pomeroy, you, those buildings.
Well, tell me about that. Tell me about these women who have made such a difference to Washington and Lee.
It's been financial. They never had a faculty member until Pamela Simpson. Never had a woman faculty member. None of them had, Mrs. Evans had two children, or one son who was killed in the war. I've forgotten what it was, but they were obviously unfulfilled women, and they liked the idea, I'm sure, of supporting these attractive young men. I only saw Miss Pomeroy once, I knew Letitia Page Evans because my mother-in-law came from Dallas to visit once, and she stayed over in Hot Springs with a friend from Dallas for a week or 10 days, and then she came on over here, and we went up to have a drink with Dr. and Mrs. Gaines, who lived in Lee House. And Bob's mother said to Frank, there's somebody you ought to meet that I've met over at the homestead. And so about a week later, we got invited to a dinner out at Pen Robin, where the Gaineses had their summer home, and it was a no holds barred. It was all the stops: Mr. Manningly, Jimmy Leyburn, Captain Dick Smith. I've forgotten. There was a whole batch of them, and Mrs. Evans, and Bob's mother. We were invited because of Bob's mother, and sure enough, got the dining hall. Bob's mother was a smart cookie. She knew how to play the game.
And did Mrs. Evans have no connection with Washington and Lee before that?
No. Bob's mother told Frank Gaines about her.
Isn't that fascinating? Well, was Dr. Gaines... I mean, he must have been incredibly charming to talk these women into doing all this.
Oh, gosh, yes. He was a charmer. He was the youngest college president in the United States at the time, I think. Now, Frank may correct me on that, but he was certainly he was in his early 30s when he became president of Washington and Lee, and he was president for, good Lord, nearly 30 years, I guess.
I know, it was a long time.
Yeah. And but Mrs. DuPont, I think, came looking as much as, after her husband died, she was the richest woman in the United States by a long shot. And she had good, very good intentions, and she set them in motion. Hollins and Dr. Gaines, I don't know whether it was true or not, but the story was that Dr. Gaines and the president of Hollins on New Year's Eve would call each other up and see how much stock they'd gotten that day from Mrs. DuPont. We got to know Mrs. DuPont through Tom Regal, who, the DuPont Awards, he was the executor of this, the DuPont Awards, for a good many years. And we would be in that when she'd come. Isn't that the cutest little dog you ever saw? yeah. And Miss Pomeroy was just somebody that a grad met in an elevator in their apartment building in New York.
Really? Isn't that interesting?
He carried her groceries. I've forgotten, but it was an elevator figure, didn't it?
Well, I just know that there are these women, but there are also women like you who worked there.
Well,
who did administrative things. What was that? Was it a circle of women when you were there, or were there?
I don't think so.
Were there other women doing the level of important
work? I was the only woman administrator at the time, until Pam was made. She served 3 years as an assistant dean.
Mm-hmm.
But I was the first. Jane Rushing was the first administrator.
Now, you were there when Pam came onto the faculty?
Mm-hmm.
Now, what was that like to have a woman arrive on faculty?
Well, I just heaved a sigh of relief. And she was tough enough to take it. I always got a feeling, a very strong feeling, that the bosses who would be in Washington Hall really didn't. Secretaries, yes, you could be a secretary, but a woman administrator, no go. That, for instance, the way I learned it was quite. It was quite obvious. All the college store managers that I knew would be talking about budget making. And I said, well, I don't have to make a budget out. And they'd say, well, don't you have a budget? And I said, I don't know. And then I began to ask, oh, we just make it for you. And there was one man who I adored. I used to call him the only sane man in Washington Hall, who would come over almost every day, and we would have coffee together. And once a month, he would slip his hand into his coat pocket and pull out the statement for the past month. So I had some idea about what I was doing. But I never was invited to a budget meeting until Stuart Epley came on, took Mr. Whitehead's place as treasurer. And I understand he got fired too, but I don't know. But
isn't that interesting?
There was a definite feeling that I probably should be home arranging flowers on the center of the dining room table, and if they'd ever seen the flowers I arranged, they wouldn't say so. But and another experience, which still rankles, I must say, there was a big safe up in the supply store area where Mr. Toller was, and at the time we were selling the textbooks for 2 or 3 days, we were doing three or four. Oh, you want a check? I'll do it. I'll mail it, or I'll do it in a minute.
Okay.
And there were days when we would have $70,000 and $80,000, having taken it in that day. And this bothered me, because they were locking the safe upstairs before we finished. We'd always have to clear the registers and finish the totals and be sure it comes out somewhere near even. And so I asked Jerry Darrell was running it. And I asked him if I could have the I never had been allowed the combination of the safe. If I could have it, have the combination to the safe. And he said, well, I'll work something out. So nothing happened. And so I asked, I went to Mr. Whitehead and asked him. It's the only time I ever went over Jerry Darrell's head, but since we were sharing a building and I considered myself an equal participant in the building. And Jim Whitehead said, sure, sure, I'll speak to Jerry. Don't worry about it. You can get the combination. Because we would have to put in this money. Well, then he called back and he said, Betty, I want you to know that any time you want to get into the big safe over here, you just bring the money on over. He backed Jerry instead of me. So, then came the winter, book sales, and I had about $70,000 in a cardboard box. And so he had said, just bring it on over and we'll put it in the big safe in the Washington Hall. So I get over there when we have finished, and I bang my door on the lock, my nose on the locked door, because it was an early leaving because Mr. Whitehead and the rest of them had gone to a faculty meeting. And I brought that money back. I had the flu. I had a temperature of 101. I was not going to run the risk of taking it home. And I went back and I hid it in that building. And, you know, it was, what it was that, well, we just don't, even though she's listed in the catalog as an administrator, women don't know how to handle money or something or other.
Mm-hmm.
But when Stuart Epley came, he treated me like a partner in the business of running the bookstore.
Wow, that's a really interesting story.
Yep.
That's a very interesting story.
I'm afraid Mr. Whitehead and I never got along very well. For one thing, I don't like bosses. I like partners, kind of, you know. He didn't like, we just didn't get along. And one time, I spoke up for the little people on campus. I'll never forget. I couldn't believe my ears. It was like talking into a feather cushion. It was just hopeless to make him understand what I meant. And he said, Betty, I agree with you absolutely. That's why I make it a point of always speaking to the grounds crew. They didn't, it was elitist. It was we happy few. I suggested, oh, yeah, that was the time I thought that the trustees might like to know who ran their textbook when I wasn't running it, and she was lousy. I said, you know, I would think the trustees would like to see the little people who do the work. And goodness knows, it's perfectly obvious that every department secretary, every secretary runs the business, whatever business it is. I said something to Jim. Particularly, I thought, that lovely Poindexter gal, black gal.
I didn't know her.
No, she was Jim Whitehead's secretary for a while. Then she moved somewhere else. And she died. She was young. I thought, wouldn't they like to know her? I was just, I didn't really, it was conversation. And Bob knew so much more about art than Jim Whitehead did. It was ridiculous.
I've taken up lots of your time. I'm really grateful.
Well, goodness, I don't know. I don't know whether I've told you what you want to hear.
I'm really, really pleased with our interview.
Good.
I think it's going to be just fine.
Good.
Thank
My mother
you.
Always...